Challenger Auditorium on the U of I Quad. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about Russia. And our guest is Karen DeWisha. She's professor in the Department of Political Science at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. She's also director of its Havinghurst Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies. A little later this week, she'll be visiting the campus, a visit sponsored by the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center. It's part of a lecture series that they have set up for this spring. She'll be talking on Thursday at 4 o'clock in room 101 of the International Studies Building, and I'm sure that anyone on the campus who is interested in hearing her should feel welcome to go. As we talk here this morning, questions are welcome too. The only thing that we ask of people calling in with questions is that they try to be brief, and we just ask that so that we can keep the program going and get in as many people as possible. But of course, questions from listeners are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, you can use that number, and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. She is educated in Britain. She is a graduate of the London School of Economics. She served as an advisor to the British House of Commons Foreign Affairs Committee and as an International Affairs Fellow of the Council on Foreign Relations. She was also a member of the Policy Planning Staff and the Bureau of Political Military Affairs in the U.S. State Department. This was in the late 80s, and until the summer of 2000, she was professor in the Department of Government and Politics at the University of Maryland. She also served as the director of its Center for the Study of Post-Communist Societies, and she's joining us this morning by telephone. Professor DeWisha, hello.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Well, thank you very much for giving us your time. We appreciate it. As a way of asking your first question, I don't know if this is too big a question or too sweeping, but I will ask it and you can take a shot at it. I wonder if it would be possible to talk about, if you make a comparison between Russia today and Russia during the Soviet period, when the Soviet Union was still in existence, I wonder, could you say something about what has changed and what remains the same?
Well, you know, it's a really interesting question. I would say, I mean, we're now coming up to 15 years since the collapse of communism in the Soviet Union, the disintegration of the Soviet Union. And if we had been talking about this subject, say, 5 years after the collapse of communism, we would say, oh, it's so different, and they're establishing democracy, and the economy is flowing into private hands, and things are looking very different. Now, people are wondering whether Russia is not going back to some of the authoritarianism that was a feature of the Soviet system without the sort of socialistic aspects of that system, which means that there's no welfare net. It's much more of a kind of has the potential for being a much more brutal form of government for ordinary people who are living there. And it's causing a lot of concern amongst academic circles and, of course, a lot of concern in Russia. So I think it is indeed a big question, but it's one that's actually very important and a lot of people in our government and in academic circles are spending a lot of time on.
I think that is something, if you ask who is responsible for that, I would imagine that a lot of the responsibility gets laid at the door of Vladimir Putin.
Sure.
And particularly if you look at what has happened over the past couple of years as he has cracked down on Soviet media, has moved to try to concentrate more power in the Kremlin, for example, reserving the power to name regional governors, the regional assemblies, they get to actually vote on that. But if they don't approve the Kremlin's choice and they do that two times, then the central government has the power actually to dissolve their regional bodies. So you really have to wonder how much of this can you directly attribute to Mr. Putin, or is there something that is in a larger sense that this is simply part of a system that was in existence for such a long time that you wouldn't really expect it to be dismantled that easily?
It's interesting that in the Soviet period, we used to sort of study the Soviet Union by basically reading political tea leaves. It's a practice called Kremlinology. And when communism fell, we thought, oh, we're not going to have to do this again. Hmm. But sadly, under Putin, it's once again the case that we really don't know what is the proper balance in our analysis between saying, oh, Putin did this, or the group around him did this. We don't really understand what the political dynamics are at the very top, but what we do know is that now, as before, understanding what's going on amongst a very top group is critical, precisely for the reasons that you identified, that the counterbalancing institutional and political forces have to a certain extent been neutralized. The press has been, particularly the mass media, the television in particular, has been stymied. Large circulation newspapers are under the control of either directly of the government or of pro-governmental forces. And the institutions of government, the Duma, are almost entirely in Putin's hands. Federation Council, the Second Chamber, also in Kremlin hands. And now the regional governors are falling in terms of being directly elected. So it's just not the case that, as it was 5 years ago, that there are counterbalancing forces to once again, the Kremlin.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about how, to the extent that we can answer this question, how people, your average Russian, feels about Mr. Putin these days. Because it's interesting, you look back to last March, he was elected to a second term. He got something like 70% of the vote. In April 2004, his approval rating was at least according to what I read, 79%. However, last month, early last month, his approval rating was down to 42%. Earlier this year, there was some demonstrations by old age pensioners who were pretty unhappy about some changes that had gone into effect, and apparently were some of the biggest public demonstrations in the year since Mr. Putin first came to power. So here, there's been over the last year, a fairly precipitous decline in his approval rating. So how do people actually feel about him these days?
Well, it is true that his approval ratings have declined, and to a certain extent, that is healthy because it shows that people are watching very carefully what he's doing and are sensitive to his role in this and are willing to hold him responsible in the opinion polls for that. The dilemma is that the approval rating for the government, I mean, remembering Putin is the president and he selects a prime minister who forms a government. The policies that have been unpopular, like the monetization of benefits, which we can talk about a bit more later, which produced the demonstrations in January, he's definitely been able to shift responsibility for the mishandling of that policy to the government. So the government's popularity ratings, approval ratings, have declined more precipitously than the approval ratings for Putin. So while Putin is less popular than he was, he's still infinitely more popular than anybody else. For example, there are many polls, but one of the polls showed the approval ratings for Putin were at around 66% at one point. And in the same polls, more or less the same percentage, about 63%, expressed disapproval of the government. So 66 for Putin, 66% against the government. Well, this is a huge gap. And what's interesting also about that is that in the same poll, only 37% said they actually trusted Putin. So 66% approve of him, but only 37% trust him, which shows a real, I would say, pretty stiff collapse amongst the population in trust for the government, even including the presidency in general. And this suggests that the kind of era in which people felt that they could trust the institutions that were emerging, the emerging democratic institutions, is over in Russia. And it leaves the door wide open for personal, you know, personal popularity of individual leaders, including leaders who might be populist, sort of a Mussolini-style movement, I think, has never been more possible in Russia.
Hmm. You know, you touch on something, that, and this was another question I wanted to raise, and again, it may be a big one. It seems like a big one, but and the question is, what do Russians, again, sort of your average Russian citizen, what do they think about the role of the state government in their lives and their relationship to it?
Well, one of the things that is, and I'm going to talk about this actually when I come to Illinois on Thursday, one of the things that this whole period and the emergence of, let's call it authoritarianism, soft or hard, depending on your point of view, in Russia demands that we consider is the whole relationship that people have had to the state in Russia over the last 20, 25 years. And it's clear that under late communism, people formed their own networks and got things done by informal means. And despite the, once communism collapsed, despite the talk about establishing the rule of law, Russia is still a pretty much lawless place. That's not to say that there's the level of, you know, contract killings in the street that we used to see, let's say, in the early 90s. It's not Chicago of the late 20s and 30s. But there is, I think, for average Russians, if you're asking that the question about average Russians do not feel that they can go to the police, for example, if they have a problem. They don't feel that they can, if they want to establish a small business, do it without bribery and corruption. And so for average Russians, the law is not something that is written in stone. It's something that's negotiated on a very individual and daily basis.
We have a caller here that I want to get to, and perhaps I should introduce again our guest, Karen DeWisha. She's professor in the Department of Political Science at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, and is also the director of its Havinghurst Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies. Questions are welcome here as we talk about Russia and the former Soviet Union. She'll be here, as I mentioned at the beginning, on the campus of the University of Illinois later this week on Thursday to give a talk. This is in a part of a lecture series sponsored by the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center, and her schedule on that day was so full, so she couldn't be with us then, but we thought we would still like to take the opportunity to talk with her, so she was good enough to do the show with us this morning by telephone. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana. Also, we have a toll-free line, code anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And we have a caller here to talk with in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hello. I wonder if you could consider the Russian governmental structures a little farther back than just 1918. It seems to me that there may not have been as much change from the Tsarist regime to the Soviet regime as people generally think. Both were highly centralized systems, with the Soviet system being somewhat more efficient. But in many respects, it was a change of leadership, but not really a great change in government structure. Is that a fair analysis?
No, I think it's. I think it's a very well. Obviously, the caller knows fully well that this is a very contentious issue in Soviet studies and Russian history. So there are a lot of views about this. But I, I do think that it is it's a question that is being placed once again on the agenda of contemporary Russian politics and the way people look at their daily life, because people are wondering whether Russians are going to have their own Orange Revolution or their Pink Revolution or their, you know, whatever color revolution one might have in their own sort of non-communist revolution to really take to the streets and to demand that this transition to democracy be completed. And a lot of the debate currently in Russia, and of course also in Russian studies in this country and elsewhere, is about whether the history of authoritarianism in Russia isn't so deep and so embedded that people cannot imagine themselves, for a variety of reasons, as anything but under a form of authoritarianism. And I think that you know, it's probably the case that in some respects the 1917 revolution today in Russia is regarded with much less awe than it was 20 years ago, but even amongst ordinary citizens. There's a certain cynicism about what the 20th century was really about.
This strain of authoritarianism really goes back to the fall of Nizhny Novgorod,
sure,
to the Mongols, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, a lot of people talk about the Mongol influence on Russian political life and the ease with which Russians slid into a form of feudalism, and of course the extent to which that became deeper at the beginning of the rule of the Tsars under Ivan III and IV. And so I think it is a question, although I'd have to say that, you know, many people who study Russian history also point to other trends in Russian history, like the Decembrists, like, you know, the anarchist and populist movements of the beginning in the 1860s, to the pressure for the freeing of the serfs, to the demands of liberals, to, you know, for example, Chicherin and Struve and so forth, at the beginning of the century, for democratic, well, or democratizing or opening reforms, to say that, you know, we shouldn't say that Russians can't do it or that Russians don't want it or don't know what sort of a normal life is. But having said that, I think that Russia will be a more difficult nut to crack than, let's say, Poland, for precisely the reasons the caller identifies, this long, centuries-old history unbroken by, let's say, the Enlightenment.
I didn't mean to take a determinist position would deny the possibility, because I don't believe that. But I think it might be more difficult.
Right.
I think there's another thing that Americans popularly don't understand. In 1900, Russia was really a third-world country.
Mm-hmm.
Practically no industrial development, very little transportation, a very poor state of education. And to the devil's credit, I guess, under the Soviet regime, they did make tremendous progress for a time, at terrible cost.
Right.
But I think we do have to remember where they were in 1900.
Right. I think, you know, the whole definition of progress in and of itself, you know, needs to be unpacked, given, you know, progress for whom, progress at what cost, and so forth. So the fact that you had hydroelectric power and a massive increase in transportation networks and the building of canals, at the end of which the slave labor that built the canals was lined up, shot, and pushed into the canal as the waters were coming through, does beg us to question the progress that was made in the 30s, because that was, of course, the time when the grossest indicators of progress were made. I mean, that was when the big jump occurred. So, you know, people now, for example, in the Russian group Memorial, are really trying to not allow really rampant nostalgia for the Soviet period to forget what the cost was of achieving the progress that was made in this period.
Without being as brutal, it seems to me that the neocons and neoliberals in some ways follow the same definition of progress. Doesn't make much difference what happens to the population, just so long as the economy progresses. And it seems to me this may have played a role in the present problems in Russia.
Well, I think that without getting into a discussion of Adam Smith and all that, just looking at it again from the perspective of ordinary Russians, you are right to say that ordinary Russians, seeing the collapse of the social safety net and seeing the increase of overt corruption and bribery and so forth that may have existed in the Soviet period but was never overt, regard the neoliberal experiment as, you know, an exercise in, let's say, the worst case, Western machinations to, you know, to rob and control Russia, Mother Russia, or at a minimum, allowed, you know, the worst excesses of the human spirit to gain control without any countervailing democratic and legal infrastructure. I mean, neoliberalism, to the extent that it works, let's say, in the United States or in Great Britain or in any of the countries in Europe, works because there's countervailing legal, moral, and political forces. Those are not yet in place to the extent that the economic forces, to the same extent that economic forces are at play in Russia. And that's why this imbalance has led to a real moral backlash against neoliberal ideas. So to that extent, I do agree with you that the structure and the pace of reform has produced a real political backlash amongst Russians to this experiment.
I want to thank the caller for his comments. We're already getting to the midpoint of the program, and I have a couple of other people who are waiting, so I want to go on to the next, and that would be someone listening in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Could you talk a little bit about how you think the Russian people are feeling about the conflict in Chechnya? And also, maybe if you could talk a little bit about whether you think that conflict is getting the attention it deserves here in the West. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
This is such a tragedy, what's happening in Chechnya. The public opinion polls show overwhelming lack of support for the manner in which the Russian generals are fighting in Chechnya, but also overwhelming hatred for the acts committed by Chechen and North Caucasian fighters, like the taking of hostages in Beslan, a small city near Chechnya where a school was invaded by a group of terrorist bombers, and in the process, hundreds of children and teachers were killed. So there's really a kind of a feeling amongst Russians of a plague on both their houses. Putin undoubtedly has lost popularity as a result of ham-fisted handling of the situation. The army as an institution, which 10 years ago was regarded in excess of 50% approval rate as one of the most trusted institutions, I think in the last polls is down around 14%. The army itself, including the forces fighting, the officer corps fighting in Chechnya, are regarded as corrupt, willing to sell the uniforms and weapons of their own soldiers. There's huge draft evasion in Russia. And actually, when you talk about the pensioners who went out in the streets of St. Petersburg and other cities in January demonstrating against the monetization of benefits, they were joined by students who were demonstrating against some of the brass's suggestions that they were going to end student deferments. Well, we know in this country that student deferments are a very important means of making the upper classes or the elite classes accept the continuation of the draft, because they, of course, don't go into the military. And so they've had to backpedal from that. And certainly the way in which Chechnya is, the war is proceeding there, is it's causing a lot of problems. And no, there isn't enough attention. And one of the reasons why Bush and Putin get along as well as they do is that Putin doesn't say anything negative about Guantanamo, and we don't say anything negative about what's going on in Chechnya. And that's, I think, an agreement.
We are just a little bit past the midpoint here. I have another call we'll get to in just a moment. Perhaps, again, I should introduce our guest, Karen DeWisha. She's professor in the Department of Political Science at Miami University of Ohio. That's in Oxford. She is also director of the Hevinghurst Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies there. She was born in the United States, educated in Britain, University of Lancaster, and also the London School of Economics. She served as an advisor to the British House of Commons Foreign Affairs Committee. She was a member of the policy planning staff and the Bureau of Political Military Affairs of the U.S. State Department. That was in the late 80s. She taught at the University of Maryland. She was professor in the Department of Government and Politics there, and then now for the past number of years has been at Miami in Ohio. She's going to be here on the campus of the University of Illinois later in the week to take part in a lecture series sponsored by the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center, talking on the topic, The Poverty of Ideology in Post-Communism, or Why Putin is Clueless, but Russia Still Loves Him. That's the title that they put on it. And she'll be giving a talk at 4 o'clock in the afternoon in room 101 of the International Studies Building on the U of I campus. And I believe that anyone who was interested in hearing her talk should certainly feel welcome. And of course, here on the program, questions are welcome too. 333-9455 for Champaign Urbana, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have another caller here, someone listening in Chicago, and we will talk with them next on our line four. Hello.
Hello, good morning. My questions are all connected, so I think it might be easier if I just ask the question and then maybe if you could answer. The first question is, I was wondering if Russia had to pay indemnity to Afghanistan after the war. My understanding was that Russia pretty much destroyed the Afghani horticulture. So that's the first question. Did they have to pay indemnity? And then the second question is, what happened with all the Russian soldiers who became addicted to heroin while they were in Afghanistan? How have they integrated into the society, or have they not? And how does this add on to the age-old problem of alcohol addiction in Russia? And is the current rising level of HIV infection in Russia any way associated with the heroin addiction? And the other thing is, what has happened? There's also rampant tuberculosis, and is that all of this also related to the collapse of centralized health care?
Well, some very good questions, all of which point to the very, very difficult state of public health in Russia. On indemnity, the Russians didn't pay indemnity. Remember, within a few years, the Taliban were in power in Russia, in Afghanistan. And so I think the Russians felt that they had, since they sent what they called, soldiers fulfilling their internationalist duty to Afghanistan in December 79, that they had already done enough to assist the Afghan people. So they felt that the biggest thing they could do to Afghanistan was to get out, and certainly the Afghans did not disagree with him at that point. The pro-Soviet puppet government that they left behind quickly collapsed, and the leaders of that group were all killed very publicly and nastily. So while they certainly continued to provide support for that government, once the government collapsed and Taliban came to power, then there was no further official indemnity paid to the state. On the issue of the soldiers who went home, well, it's a very similar situation to the way in which our own Vietnam vets were treated when they came home. There weren't the kinds of yellow ribbons and around the trees and local communities turning around out with parades like we're now getting with soldiers and units coming back from Iraq. Soldiers who came back from Afghanistan were secreted back to their communities, and this was for a couple of reasons. One was that the Russians had always suppressed figures about who was getting killed, and coffins used to be flown home in the middle of the night in Afghanistan, and people didn't even know that they were going to be receiving a coffin until the coffin arrived. So that there was, no public information about casualties of any kind, and certainly no discussion until Gorbachev came to power of the drug trade between Afghanistan and the Soviet Union, which was, of course, carried out by corrupt Soviet officers. And those Soviet officers and that network is still in place because the 201st Russian Airborne Division is still placed today on the border between Tajikistan and Afghanistan. And it is there to protect the border, but also it is a major entry point for drugs coming into Russia from Afghanistan. Even though Tajikistan is an independent country, there are still Russian troops there. On the other related questions of alcohol, HIV, and TB, well, disability and public health crises in general are not the subject of, let's say, state mobilization in the same way they would have been under the Soviet period. So people are being cast into the private sector to get medicines and treatment as best as they can. And HIV and TB, and the version that is in Russia is drug resistant, is particularly exacerbated by the fact that it's being passed in the army and in the prisons. So two places where young men are kept in rather large numbers in Russia are subject to really a huge public health scandal. They calculate that at least one-third of all prisoners in Russia have drug-resistant TB. So it's a major incubator for the spread of this disease worldwide, because a lot of people get out of prison in Russia and leave the country with this TB, and it's spreading through this incubator. So the caller is very correct to point to the public health problem that is a feature of the collapse of the state in Russia.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
Just a bit ago, a caller raised the question of Chechnya. And I thought maybe I might ask you to talk a little bit more about the North Caucasus, since here is a region there where there has been a lot of unrest with people fighting the Russians and people fighting each other all along Russia's southern border. And certainly the Russians have been fighting with Chechen rebels since 1994, but there are other places like Dagestan and Ingushetia and North Ossetia and Abkhazia, these places where there are independence movements and also, as I said, people, not only people fighting with the Russians, but with each other, a very difficult neighborhood and a real serious challenge for Russia and its security along that along a long stretch of its southern border.
How
do you see this playing out over time, do you think, and how do the Russians see this region?
Well, I think it's let's put it this way, in Russian terms, I'm an optimist. In other words, I think the situation is hopeless but not catastrophic. You know, when you list the republics that you did, Dagestan, Chechnya, and Ingushetia, they are all inhabited by a majority Muslim population. And the area to the north, which is Russia, and the areas to the south, consisting of Georgia and a little bit further south, Armenia, are Christian. So you have a situation in which you have Muslim peoples who've been there for centuries being surrounded by Christian peoples. And historically, under the Russian Empire, the Russians have cooperated with the Georgians to contain the Muslim peoples in the mountains of the North Caucasus. Of course, there are Azerbaijan is Muslim as well. But in general, these mountain peoples of the Caucasus have all the makings of dissatisfaction. They are surrounded by people who want to contain them. They have an distinct ethnicities, different from each other. They have different languages, and they share certain features of Islam, but there are differences between them, amongst them as well. And so it's not a happy scenario. And while Russia has been at war with Chechnya in the post-Soviet period, of course, they also have been at war with Chechnya during the Soviet period. They transported the Chechens and other peoples of the North Caucasus during the Second World War to Kazakhstan, and even in the 19th century, the Russian Empire suppressed the people of the North Caucasus. So I can't imagine a situation in which this problem is going to easily be resolved. And this is exacerbated by Putin's own arrogance, his ignorance, and his brutality in the handling of the situation. Just in the last month, we've had the assassination of a moderate, relatively speaking, a moderate leader of Chechnya, Makhadov. And he was really somebody who had support in Chechnya, but was not in favor of using the most brutal means for prosecuting that war. As sort of what we might see as an Arafat, which, and I use this comparison not lightly, because of course Arafat is hated by a segment of the Israeli population, but also regarded as somebody with whom you could at least deal, not necessarily trustworthy. And but in the absence of Maskhadov, the field is completely open only to extremists in Chechnya. And I really don't understand what the Putin plan is for any sort of negotiated peace in Chechnya. I think it is really a kind of hopeless situation.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to think back to when he was elected the first time. It seemed to me, as I remember it, one of the pitches that he made was, I can be the guy who can take care of this problem. And he presented this image of a tough guy, somebody who was going to really get in there, was going to be tough on Chechnya, and was going to get that situation taken care of and cleaned up.
Yeah.
And of course, now all these years later, he has not been able to.
No, absolutely. And you may remember that when Yeltsin was still in power, and so this was in 1999, toward the end of the year, and Putin was his prime minister and had just been appointed and was going to come in and, as you say, deal with this situation in a kind of very sharp and quick fashion. He talked about the Chechen terrorist, which is how, of course, they're regarded in Russia, who had been blamed for two really horrendous apartment building bombings in Moscow. He said he was going to seek them out and destroy them wherever they were, even if they're in the Russian term, sitting in the outhouse. And, you know, really brutal, nasty kind of thuggish talk on Putin's part. And that was 99. Well, what has he done? He's killed a lot of Chechens, but he's killed in the process of trying to save Russians. He's killed many more Russians that have been taken hostage by Chechens in the process of trying to rescue them. The Russians go in and kill everybody, and that's the Russian version of not negotiating. Mm-hmm. They go in and they kill everybody, and it's simply unspeakable what's happening in both in Chechnya and the lack of control and discipline amongst the Russian special forces.
You know, last week here on the program, I had the opportunity to talk with Georgia's ambassador to the United States. He was here on the campus, and we spent quite a bit of time, perhaps more than he would have liked, talking about the relationship between Russia and Georgia, particularly about the feelings of the Georgians that the Russians are meddling in an unproductive way in these two areas in Georgia where there are separatist movements, South Ossetia and Abkhazia. We talked about the fact that Russia has for a long time now considered the areas on its borders to be its sphere of influence, that this area that they call the near abroad in Russia, that encompasses what used to be the former republics of the Soviet Union and the countries of the Warsaw Pact. And clearly, the Russians saw this as part of their defense structure for their homeland, thinking that if anybody was going to try to get to Russia, they'd got to go through these other places first.
Right.
And that's where they would have liked the land battle to be fought if there was going to be one. And clearly, the Russians continue to feel that this is their sphere of influence and want to try and maintain influence there and have continued to try to do that in Georgia, in Ukraine, and no doubt have been, as we know, have been pretty unhappy about not only the Soviet Union coming apart, but the increasing building of ties between former Soviet republics and the countries of Europe and organizations like NATO. How do the Russians think about that, particularly this what they still consider to be their sphere of influence, even though there are plenty of people in that sphere that think that the Russians should mind their own business, and they're looking towards Europe, they're not looking towards Russia.
Yeah, the Russians are. I think that you capture the the Russian sense well, that the Russians are thinking that if the West is going to encroach on their territory or to seek to undermine the integrity of the Russian state, that they're going to try to gain influence in all the countries in the so-called near abroad. And this is, of course, what we're seeing. American troops are now stationed in several countries in Central Asia. They're stationed in Georgia. And they're very fearful that they're soon going to be stationed in Ukraine. The Russians' choice is that if there is going to be a continuation, not a repeat, but a continuation of the centuries-old kind of pushing on Russia's borders, that they would like this to take place in somebody else's territory, not inside Russia, which means that they have to push back against Western encroachment by themselves putting pressure on Georgia, in this case, to accept the stationing of Russian troops and to put pressure on the Central Asian states to accept the continuation of Russian forces on their territory. So in the Kyrgyz Republic, for example, where in the last couple of months we've seen the so-called Pink Revolution, although clearly it's more of a pink coup d'etat than a revolution, there are both American and Russian troops stationed. And this, I think, is the pattern that we're seeing emerge, that the Russians can't prevent these governments from accepting the placing of American forces and, the good amount of money that flows with that in terms of aid. But they are going to also put a lot of pressure on these governments to make sure that their forces and their people stay in those countries and that they keep the pressure on the West elsewhere, and that it doesn't come abut right up against Russian territory.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone in Kankakee on our toll-free line, line 4, right here. Hello.
Would you please survey for us the Russian church and present Russian church-state relations? Thank you.
Well, one of the things that's important to keep in mind when we look at church-state relations is that when we think about ordinary Russians and the life of ordinary Russians, they are flooded with a lot of negative images and a lot of crises that affect their everyday, economic crises that affect their everyday lives, and the collapse of belief and, let's say, the shining ideal of socialism, as it used to be called. And so they have really been searching for a replacement for that belief system. And there has been a very great increase in the levels of attendance at church in all denominations, including Protestant churches in Russia. The Orthodox Church has been very much a part of that, and they've been very well. Of course, they've been active and never closed down under the Soviet period entirely, although suppressed and persecuted and controlled. But they've been very involved in the restoration of churches. Political leaders often find it very useful to have their projects blessed by priests, so there's been a kind of growth, once again, of the cozy church-state relationship. But Putin himself also is a churchgoer and is regarded by many as actually a fervent believer and has given a lot of breaks to the Orthodox Church to try to keep back the growth of Protestant religions, communities, and Catholicism in Russia. And I think it's very appropriate to mention on a day like today, when we have the conclave of the cardinals meeting in Rome, that one of the great tragedies of John Paul's papacy was that he did not succeed in getting a meeting with the Russian Orthodox Church. As much progress as he made in meeting with people in Jerusalem, with chief rabbi in Rome, with leaders of Muslim communities, he did not succeed in any breakthrough with the Russian Orthodox Church whatsoever. So they do see themselves very much as holders of the faith against, positively in favor of a unique Russian way, and that is not a Western way. So they have been very much part of the kind of Eurasian or Slavophile revival, and very much supporters of the state policy in that area.
We're coming down to the point here. We just have a couple minutes, unfortunately. Maybe one last thing. We have seen some popular political protests sweeping out governments in this part of the world. In Georgia in 2003, we had the Rose Revolution, and there were people who were very unhappy with Mr. Shevardnadze, who was the president, thought the government was very corrupt, and swept him out of office. Last year, something similar happened in Ukraine when Viktor Yushchenko was swept into office after protests over fraud in presidential elections involving the man who was clearly the back candidate of Russia, Viktor Yanukovych. And then we also had what has happened recently in Kyrgyzstan, although I think a lot of people are quick to point out that that's different. It's not like Ukraine and Georgia. But having said all that, some people do say, well, you know, is there any kind of a possibility for this kind of popular political protest to have that kind of powerful effect in Russia?
Well, I can assure you it's a subject for a lot of discussion in the U.S. government and in academic circles. And I can also assure you that just as nobody foresaw the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, nobody knows the answer to this question about Russia. I think it is sad to say that people now are regarding it as the only hope for getting the country back on the track away from authoritarianism. I think it's a really very sad statement about the institutionalization or lack of institutionalization of democratic reforms in Russia, that people accept that their all the in-system ways for dealing with this situation in Russia have more or less been exhausted. And so when we say, yes, it might happen, that's not necessarily a hopeful scenario, simply because people are accepting that the mass media is not pushing back, the institutions of government are not pushing back, the regions are not pushing back. And I would say that in Ukraine or in Georgia, whereas the population can rally around the nation on an anti-Russian basis and be in favor of democracy because they see Russia becoming more and more authoritarian, in Russia, who do they push back against? They're going to push back against the West if there's a popular uprising. And that may mean that the people who are going to lead and come out into the streets may not be the democratic youth, but may be the skinheads, the extremists, and there are plenty of them in Russia amongst young people. And that's why, you know, even if we say our last hope is in popular uprising, we should be very careful in Russia what we wish for, because it's not the case that may necessarily be the best result. After all, the 20th century, we had two strong anti-Western popular uprisings in the 1930s, one in Italy and one in Germany. And the same thing could happen in Russia. We should be very, very careful about that.
Well, there we'll have to stop. Our guest, Karen DeWisha, is professor of political science at Miami University of Ohio in Oxford. She's also director of the Havinger Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies. Professor DeWisha, thanks very much for talking with us.
Nice to talk to you, David, and I look forward to being there on Thursday.
Very good. Programs here on AM 580 made possible by grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone roundtables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. The broadcast also made possible by grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at The Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned because coming up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about self-defense with three guests. They're instructors in a program designed to provide realistic self-defense strategies for women, regardless of their age, experience, or strength. That follows the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Let's take a look now at what's happening.